With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
And good Saturday morning. Welcome into another edition of More Outdoors. We also joined this morning by Rex Caffey of LSU Sea Grant. Very controversial topic we're going to discuss this morning, that of the public access and to public and private waters. And Wendy, I'm going to let you pick it up from here, my dear. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Don. Good morning, Keith. Are you with us?
I am with you. Y'all surviving this west wind attack?
West wind?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't noticed, Keith.
No.
I guess we're surviving. I think the charter fishermen have given up on trout, though, so they've resorted to redfish now. I guess that may be part of the reason. Rex,
yeah,
are you here?
It. I'm here, Wendy. Can you hear me?
Okay, yes, I hear you fine. We'll jump right into this. As most of our listeners know, HB 391 regarding the public versus private water issue failed to pass this past March. And we've been talking about this topic for several years and have heard stories on both sides of the issue, stories of fishermen being run off from places they've fished for years and stories of private lease estates being vandalized. And both sides on this issue seem very passionate about their stances. The failed bill, HB 391, would have in part provided for, and I just kind of want to set this up for anybody that's listening that might, I don't see how, but might be behind the times. So I'm going to quote this part of the bill real quick. The public navigation of running waters, including those running waters passing over any privately owned water bottom directly connected to a state-owned water bottom that is subject to the ebb and flow of the tide. So there's much more to the bill, and since it failed, we won't go over all that this morning except to say that this issue has gained widespread publicity both on Don's radio shows and on several social media and online platforms. But everyone was so focused on the issue and HB 391, it slipped by most of us that in the spring of 2017, Representative Truck Gisclair and Representative Ray Garofalo co-authored House Resolution Number 178. Mandating the Louisiana Sea Grant Program to, and I quote, assemble representatives of interested organizations, groups, and individuals, including several government agencies, and to facilitate those meetings to possibly recommend legislation to create a voluntary public recreational servitude of use of waterways, and to find common ground among the various interested groups and individuals on issues of temporary access to traverse private water bottoms without causing any transfer or risk of transfer of the owner's property rights, including all surface and mineral rights and the non-interference with private commercial activity. This research should also include a determination of the availability of federal funding for the research, projects, or incentives to those parties entering into a voluntary public recreational servitude of use of waterways. Now, that's a whole lot of jargon right there, but I think that the job was a big job, and it was well laid out. So Sea Grant's resulting report titled, and this is a huge title, there'll never be an acronym for this, Preliminary Options for Establishing Recreational Servitudes for Aquatic Access Over Private Water Bottoms, and it was released in early March of this year, before HB 391 went for the vote. So, like we said, with us this morning, we have Dr. Rex Caffey of Louisiana Sea Grant, who was deeply involved in the facilitation of this gathering of the minds, resulting in this 64-page report of their findings. So, Rex, before we all get to our questions, I would like you to briefly tell us what Sea Grant is and what your position is with Sea Grant.
Thanks, Wendy. Can everybody hear me pretty good?
Sound great.
Okay.
Sound good.
So, first of all, thanks to Don, to Wendy, and Keith for having me on this morning. And, again, my name is Rex Caffey. I work for the LSU Ag Center and for Louisiana Sea Grant. The Sea Grant side of my appointment is where this work was done. And let me just quickly say that Sea Grant is a mirror of the land grant system. And the land grant systems were established at public universities across the U.S. over 100 years ago. And Louisiana Sea Grant was established 50 years ago in 1968. And it mirrors what a land grant college does. It does applied research and extension teaching. But instead of working with agricultural mechanical stakeholders, we focus mostly on coastal and marine challenges. And I can tell you more about the context of how we got involved in the report, but that's basically, you know, the Sea Grant network. And one other thing is that your listeners may know of our Sea Grant program through our agents that work and live in the communities they serve. So throughout the coastal zone, we have about 20 agents and specialists that work mainly in marine sciences.
And what is your position with Sea Grant, Rex?
I'm the director of marine extension. My background is natural fisheries and marine economics.
And marine economics. Okay. Let's, I guess for those listening who maybe had no idea what we were going to talk about, I'm thinking maybe could you summarize for us? I know in that report there were 10 major options that I think were decided upon. Could you start with those? You may have to go to break before you finish, but could you quickly go over those 10 options, voluntary options?
And sure, and we can spend time later getting into details. But the 10 options are creative leasing, that's one, and that's kind of a WMA-light sort of approach. We know that WMAs are used to set aside private lands for public use through contracts. Temporary access for special events like tournaments. Public acquisition, which is expensive, buying or leasing land for easements for public use. Increased liability protection is number 4. Tax incentives, number 5. Number 6 is a little confusing to some because it's titled acquisitive prescription limitations. And most of us know that as squatter's rights. This idea that if someone stays on your property, traverses your property, navigates it for a certain amount of time, they may acquire a right of servitude. And so needs to be addressed to some extent for all these options. Boundary fixing and decoupling of mineral rights are two options that are closely related, and that's two that the landowner side was very interested in because our coastal zones are eroding very rapidly, and they are concerned about losing property rights as those boundaries erode. Number 9 is incentivizing access via our coastal restoration programs. And then finally, providing more – this is really an incentive, but it's really a need – providing more funding for increased frequency, quality, and capacity for mapping at the state land office.
What I find interesting real quick about the mapping is that the idea is that the coastline is changing so rapidly that by the time the mapping is done, it's no longer accurate. Is that right?
That's unfortunately true. In 2006, the legislature passed a resolution for the very same reasons where we are today, instructing the state land office to really do a full revision of all the mapping. And they spent 10 years doing that, working with United States Geological Survey and contractors. And the problem in a fluid landscape like coastal Louisiana is that you can map an area and come back in a few weeks, a month even, and those boundaries have changed dramatically. And that's a unique problem, and it's at the heart of this issue.
You mentioned incentives for coastal restoration. Can you just touch on that before we go to break in a couple minutes?
Yeah, I'll just say it quickly. The oldest program that we have for coastal restoration is called CWPRA, C-W-P-P-R-A, Coastal Wetland Protection Restoration Act, excuse me. And they fund a list of projects every year based on a series of metrics or parameters that they think are very important. The notion with this option is that one of those metrics and one of those decision criteria should be, does the project provide some modicum of coastal access? Does it allow for access? It wouldn't be the overriding decision criteria, but it's being asserted that that should be part of the decision set.
But that is a factor that is now not considered.
No.
So this would be a new option.
It would be a new option. I mean, the main consideration when we select restoration projects are cost efficacy. You know, what is the bang for the buck we're getting in terms of habitat, land building,
there's some other metrics like public-private partnerships, federal sponsors, cost, of course. But no, access, to my knowledge, is not a formal criteria for selecting projects right now.
Okay. I think I'll give Don and Keith a couple minutes to formulate their questions. I can already hear the wheels spinning. We will take a break. You're listening to Hunt, Fish, Talk, and we're talking about public access to private waters. The seems to be the hot topic for the past couple of years. And we will be right back in just a couple minutes. Welcome back in to Hunt, Fish, Talk, and we're here this morning with Rex Caffey of Louisiana Sea Grant, and we're discussing voluntary options for providing public access to private waters. This was a resulting report that was mandated for Sea Grant to do. And it's my understanding that, you know, you all had to hold these meetings with these different user groups, and all of that's included in the document, also the minutes of those stakeholder groups. And I have a question for you, Rex, before we go to Don and Keith. And I'm not sure that you can answer this, because I know that as a representative of Sea Grant, you must stay, you know, neutral and stick to the facts. But did any one stakeholder group seem more open to voluntary options and solutions?
I wouldn't say any one group was more than the other. I think it depended on the option at hand. And the two that I think – well, let me start with the one that everybody agreed on, and that's that last one, increased capacity for mapping. I think everybody agrees that no matter how big the challenge is for coastal Louisiana's boundary delineation, we've got to find a way to do our very best to get the most recent information on boundaries into people's hands for both private and public use. So that was one that they all agreed on. The other issue that I think there may be some traction on is this idea of boundary fixing, and the separation of the surface rights and the subsurface rights. And Louisiana is unique compared to many other states that allow property owners to sell or to disaggregate the surface and the subsurface. And there's some thought among all parties that that might be one option that would maybe point the needle a little bit more towards public access if the state could acquire some of the surface rights as long as the landowners were able to secure their subsurface rights.
So the state could have the surface as long as the owner retained the subsurface rights?
Well, the details of that have yet to be worked out. You know, this is very preliminary, but yes, essentially the idea would be if the surface rights were made available for public use, either through some sort of an easement or donation, that a boundary or a fixing of the subsurface rights could be assured for some fixed period of time, even perpetuity. Now, there's some complications with all these options that need to be further addressed, and as I understand it, that's what this task force is going to be looking more into.
Okay. Keith, mm-hmm. How about I start with you? Do you have a question for Rex based on what we've talked about thus far?
Well, let me just preface everything with saying that the private land and slash waters issue, I believe, is the biggest threat to recreational fishermen and hunters in since my lifetime, really. You know, there are a lot of issues we talk about here on Hunt, Fish, Talk. We talk about the Roseau Cane being destroyed, the mealybugs, coastal erosion in general, you know, freshwater diversions, and they're all something to be aware of. And these are issues that affect the sportsmen here in South Louisiana. But this issue, I believe, has the potential to really reshape the way we operate here in what's always been known as sportsman's paradise. And if you don't think so, just look at the speed and the ferocity that the land is now being claimed. Every time this goes to court and with every win that the landowners get, it's becoming more clear to them, the landowners, that the law is on their side and they may as well go ahead and take the water too. And frankly, I don't know how we can solve this. I mean, I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but I think this is a good thing that the Sea Grant is doing. If anything, maybe it can and keep open a dialogue between landowners and fishermen. It's really not much that fishermen are asking, really. It's not that we want to change or we're asking landowners to change the way they're doing things. All we're asking is to be able to fish the same waters that we fish all our lives. But the question comes down to, if it's legal to claim water around your land, what are you going to do it? And if the landowners can legally do it, then why not? I do have a question for Rex. Can you define what is decoupling of mineral rights?
Well, maybe I can try and do a better job at that. If you sell a parcel of land in Louisiana, coastal Louisiana, you're selling the cake and the frosting, so to speak. The surface rights and the subsurface rights are bundled together in one deed. In other states, you can sell the or donate the surface and the subsurface as separate entities or separate parcels. And so there's some thought or hope, perhaps, that if the law were addressed to allow this, then it would address one of the bigger concerns that the coastal property owners have, and that is their subsurface rights. Because if they lose a boundary or their boundary diminishes on the surface, under current law, their subsurface boundary and their mineral rights actually diminish as well. So disconnecting those two, as is the case in other states, might go a long way to addressing some of this.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think that's one thing that really needs to be focused on then. I thought that was what it was, but I just needed you to go over that. And so that's actually separating the water top from the water bottom.
That's right. And, I mean, I don't want to give the impression, and I'll say this at least a couple times, that these things have been finalized. We were asked to do something a little bit difficult, and that is with no funding and resources in 6 months, come up with whatever options we could. And the report consists of, I think, a good overview of the context and the history of this problem, how we kind of got to where we are today. And those preliminary options are provided in a very neutral way. We talk about what the landowner position is. We talk about what the fishing community positions tended to be from the ones we talked to. And then we talk about sort of the pros and cons or the issues that would have to be addressed if any one of these things were further pursued.
And this was done in closed meetings with each separate stakeholder. Is that correct, Rex?
Right. We worked with on the fishing side. We worked with, obviously, the Louisiana Sportsman Coalition. We worked with Daryl and the Charter Boat Association. I think we had a member of the East Ascension Sportsman League. On the landowner side, the major landowners to the Louisiana Landowners Association. We had a separate meeting also with the State Lands Office and also for the Attorney General's Office. And I want to back up and say the reason that Sea Grant kind of got involved in this to begin with is, as Wendy and Don knows, I know you guys from my days working in outreach with the outdoor writers. And about 3 years ago, I called Don. I said, Don, this is blowing up. I'm hearing about it on your show. I want to make sure our marine agents are fully aware of both sides of this issue. Can you recommend some people to talk to on the fishing side? I already had some recommendations on the landowner side. And we held a meeting in the summer of 2016. And at that time, we were, Keith, I have to kind of echo what you said, a little bit overwhelmed with the complexity of this. It was not our intent to move forward beyond just informing ourselves. But when Truck Just Clear a year later filed the resolution, we took up the mantle to do the assessment. So that's kind of how we got here today.
Well, you didn't really have any choice.
No, we don't. And before I forget, and I'll say it at the end, because I know Don is always good about asking how can a listener contact or find more information. And rather than giving you a complicated web address, if you, the listener, were to go to the search engine of choice, you know, Google or like Internet Explorer, and just type in Louisiana Coastal Access Report, those four words, or you could say Louisiana Coastal Access Study. Either way, the first two hits are going to be different links to our work.
Okay. Good. Don?
Well, Rex, I just wanted to say to you, first of all, to start off, I mean, congratulations on a job well done. To call what you had basically dumped in your lap an undaunting task is an understatement. No resources, no time. Go out and find us a solution to this problem and report back to the legislature. And I know you would never say that, but you guys had an almost impossible job, and I think you reacted very quickly, and you've come up with some really good options. But to let people know where we're going from here, 391 failed. What do we expect to see in next year's legislation, and how might it be influenced or formulated through the development of this task force?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that, because as some of your listeners know, there was two competing bills in this last session to create task forces to address this issue, one by Representative Garofalo of St. Bernard through the House, and then one by Senator Alain through the Senate. And the Senate version passed. I'm looking at it now. It's got 23 representatives. And so That is a pretty large task force, and I don't know if that's as manageable as they hope. Maybe it is. I won't bore your readers with all the representation on here, but I'm looking at their objective, and it is basically to make concrete policy recommendations to the legislature in order to address the issue of public access on navigable waters of the state. So I take that to mean that they will probably start off by looking at our report and building from there, but they may also suggest and go forward with actual policy changes in law. And some have asked us, why didn't you do that? Why didn't Sea Grant do that? And I'll tell you, you don't want your university faculty advocating for or against certain policies. I mean, our job is to be descriptive, not prescriptive. But this task force may actually come up with some recommendations along the lines of subsurface and surface separation, along the lines of something even as aggressive as what we saw earlier this year with Senator Pearson's or Representative Pearson's bill. So I think we're at a point now where the first meeting has yet to be held. It was a very busy session. And Wendy, I know you've been trying to reach them. Have you heard back whether or not they're setting a date yet for their first meeting of this task force?
No, I emailed Allen's office. And by the way, I'm still looking at the information. I didn't realize there were two opposing task force assignments. I'm still looking at the other one that only has 13 representatives. So
yeah.
there were two, and Allen's is the one that went through.
That's correct.
So is that, do you know what House resolution number that is?
So the first one that I saw was HB 60 or HCR 60, I guess, which would have been Garofalo. Yeah, that one did not pass. And then Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 99, so SCR 99, and that is Senator Allen's task force.
Okay. Well, yes, I emailed his office asking where they stood on that. I didn't hear anything back. I was at least hoping to hear that, you know, they were deferring till they, you know, recovered from this session, this legislative session, or maybe they had tentative plans to start in the fall. But is there a deadline that they are to issue their report before the next session next year? Was there a date mentioned in there?
There is a date. It says the task force shall make recommendations to the legislature no later than February 1st of 2020. So that's their
2020.
Deadline. Yes. Yeah. At which time the task force shall cease to exist unless there's, you know, a need to continue it. So, it begins in September 2018 is what it's saying here. So I would assume the first meeting would be sometime in September. And I want to, you know, make sure that we don't pick on the senator too much here because – this has been a pretty tough session, and they were in debate up till just about a week ago on the fiscal cliff, so I'm sure that took a lot of their time. This is a pretty big issue. I would imagine it's going to get the full attention.
We don't have a date yet.
Right.
I'm working off of old information, so I'm thinking if y'all were pushed to get this done in 6 months, you know, I was thinking that they should have already at least called the first meeting. So now we're hearing, I'm sorry I didn't have updated information, that this is report's not due until 2020. We'll talk about more about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Hunt Fish Talk on WWL 105.3 FM HD2. We'll be right back. Welcome back into Hunt Fish Talk. We have a guest this morning with us, Rex Caffrey from Louisiana Sea Grant, and we're talking about their findings. They were mandated by a resolution to write a report and come up with some voluntary options for settling this issue once and for all. I think that's maybe a little bit easier said than done, but they did come out with a report, and we're talking about that this morning. And, Rex, I have a question that you might not be able to answer, so I'm going to kind of put you in the hot seat for a minute. I'm just curious to know that if Sea Grant received any feedback after the report was released, because I think the estimate is it came out maybe a couple weeks before the HB 391 went for the vote. I don't know if those involved reading the report, if it would have had any impact on the way they voted one way or the other. But did you get any feedback? Did any of the participants get any feedback about
the
report?
I'll be as candid as I can be on this and tell you that we were so concerned that we would be inundated with all kind of questions and controversy that we did what's called a soft release on 1st of March. Not a whole lot of press release, not a whole lot of fanfare, because we just assumed, very incorrectly, by the way, that we were going to get inundated with information requests. And I think we would have ordinarily, but what happened, as you know, you said in the beginning of the show, is HB 391 came out basically on the eve of our report being released. And it basically took all the attention towards that instrument. And so for several months, that was what the talk was about, both in social media, in the outdoor media, certainly in the different camps on both sides of this. And so we didn't get very much feedback or response whatsoever. We're starting to get some now. I think after today's show, we may get more visitations to the site reading the report. But no, we expected a lot and didn't get much, at least not initially.
That surprises me. But I've said before on this show many times, I'm just kind of simple-minded and naive when it comes to these things. So I really would like to know if the legislators who mandated this report through that House resolution, if they even read the report. This just blows me away. Do you have any way of knowing that?
Yeah, so I'll tell you that we met with the two representatives that authored HB 178, both before and after it was completed. They read it. That was Garofola and Truck Just Claire.
And
I would assume others have read it. It was certainly held up a lot during the debate, both as sort of a shield and also something to criticize. So there's no shortage of references to it. How much actual, you know, reading of the detail, I'm not sure. Now, you mentioned it's a 63-page report, and you also said there's a lot of appendices. The report proper is only about 23 pages. It's not hard to read.
No, it's not.
It's systematic. We put the option out there. We say, here's what this option would do, and here's what the landowner position that we heard regarding this option is, and here's what the recreational fishing position is. And then we weigh in from our areas of subject matter expertise very objectively and neutrally on what issues would have to be addressed if that particular option were to go forward. And that's mostly from law, but also from economics and coastal science.
So let's be clear. You met with the stakeholders in individual separate meetings.
Right.
There were no shouting matches, correct?
Right. I think the initial plan was we're going to have this gigantic meeting with everybody involved, and it was, given the time that we had, with very short fuse on this timeline, we felt like it'd be much more efficient to work through different stakeholder groups and then overlay what they had to say and see where there was some issues that bubbled up from each meeting that were common ground. And maybe they weren't complete consensus or even partial, but things that came up in each meeting time and time again are what made it into this report.
Okay.
Things that did come up that just, you know, didn't see the light of day because they were just one-off things that really had no potential whatsoever, and we wanted to make sure that these are options that might have at least some chance of moving forward. And incidentally, these options are not necessarily that novel. Sea Grant commissioned a study or was asked to do a study very much like this in the 1970s, probably for some of the same reasons. And we found that old study in the process of writing this one, and it's hauntingly similar in what they came up with as far as options. It just kind of shows you how long this issue's been out there and the lack of really serious progress there's been in regards to the issue.
I'm going to ask you another hard question, and if I already asked it, I don't know why I don't remember the answer. But except that Don threw me off schedule when we started talking about this new resolution. So I was saving that for the end. But were there any stakeholders that stood out as being very much in favor of voluntary options and very much against voluntary options? Can you say that?
So I think my general observation is, over the course of developing the report late last summer when we started, the resolution passed about this time last year, the end of the summer session, through the fall, is that everybody at the table for the different groups was generally positive about the idea of a voluntary incentive-based approach. So I think they were generally willing to try and make the process work. What happened, however, is after HB 391 came about, there was some in the fishing community that really did not want to discuss this report. They really wanted to go for the law change. And that's within their right to push that if they want to try and get that legislation passed. And they may try again this coming year. But because that was a different tack, that was a different approach, it probably de-emphasized or reduced their interest in the report that they'd been part of developing. So hopefully there'll be a return to that through this task force. And I want to say one other thing, Wendy, that before I forget, there's a perception out there that this is really the big fishing organizations and the big oil companies, the big landowner issue, big landowner interest. And that's true. But there are a lot of, there's a lot of variation in the fishing community and in the landowner community on this that we're learning about. And there's actually a lot of small-scale operations, especially small-scale landowners, that probably need to be at the table as well as different fishing interests. And I see that's going to be allowed through this 23-member task force.
Or at least it is.
Right. Well, there's the option there. Reading this, it looks like there will be an option. For example, the Louisiana Sportsman Coalition is going to have three appointees. CCA is going to have an appointee. Again, those are just four. There's 19 more appointees. But I think the state would do well to try and get a good, varied representation of the different interests involved here and not just, again, limit it to the larger combatants, if you will.
Right. So you don't want to go ahead.
I was just wanting to ask a question. Were you in these talks? Did you witness them?
So, Keith, can you repeat that? You cut out.
Did you witness these talks, these meetings, the program?
Yeah, I was at every one of them.
Okay, right. Okay. Yeah. And I know you can't share too much, but did you get a sense of what might be the option that has the most potential?
Yeah, earlier I said, and this is the one that everybody agreed on, and that is we've got to address this capacity, this employee capacity at State Lands Office. They've had a lot of attrition over the years, and they've lost a lot of their expertise and intellectual knowledge, and that's a big issue, especially in a rapidly eroding state like we have here in coastal Louisiana. So they all agreed on that. I would say the two I mentioned earlier, boundary fixing and then the separation of surface and subsurface, is an area where both the fishermen and the landowner said, yeah, we're interested in a little more dialogue along these policy options. The other one, which surprised me a little bit, was this coastal restoration issue. That was something that the fishing groups pushed hard for, and I understand the rationale for that. If you look at QIPRA that I mentioned earlier, and there are other programs that are even bigger, like CPRA's master plan, but if you look at QIPRA, the funding for that project comes from the Sports Fish Restoration Act. And so the funding comes from excise taxes on sporting goods. And their assertion was, look, this restoration program is being funded through excise taxes on sporting goods, primarily fishing. We feel like fishing access should be one of the many things that are considered when a project is selected. And so I think that's another area. The one observation I'll add here is that those options, and you can look at the report and see them, that are going to be very expensive, like public acquisition, buying land, buying easements, they're going to be difficult to finance in a state that's really struggling right now with their budget. So I think the budget-neutral options are the ones that are less expensive, that can be done on a small-scale trial basis, are probably the ones that are going to have legs.
Yeah. And when I read through this report, that's what hit me. Even if we do agree on one of these, there's a next step. There's the incentives. There's the tax cuts. And how likely are you to get a tax cut, with how bad we're hurting for money? But option 9 really intrigues me, because this is the one, like you said, it talks about money going towards coastal restoration projects, rebuilding of private land. So this is money taken from, the recreational side to go towards the coastal Wetlands Restoration Act that was passed.
Yeah, so, and let me clarify that under QIPRA that's the case, but under the bigger program that CPRA does, CPRA is the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority, they use different sources of funds, usually oil and gas royalty sharing and penalty funds for the Deepwater Horizon. Those aren't from federal excise taxes on sporting goods. So CWIPRA is a little bit more small scale than CPRA.
Okay, but there is some from an excise tax on hunting and fishing expenditures.
Yes.
See, this is what rubs most folks the wrong way. I mean, rebuilding private land and then the private landowners say you can't fish on our waters. It's almost like a slap in the face. So this one, I think there's something there. The option nine, that really screams out to me that this one has some kind of potential.
I think that that you're right, that, you know, both sides in different venues, some in our meeting, there was an LPB public forum where the landowners said they'd be willing to consider this. Both sides expressed some willingness to really pursue this more thoroughly. I think it may have some legs, but I want to make sure I weigh in on the other side of this issue, because I don't want to give the impression that I'm only sort of echoing what the fishermen's concerns were on this option. On the landowner side, they said, and this is true, that, a lot of this expenditure goes to public expenditure goes to private lands. But that's true for the Farm Bill's conservation title. It's been true in coastal Louisiana for years. And the idea has been, we got a coastal zone that's 80% privately owned. It's invariable that we're going to end up doing publicly funded restoration on private lands. The rationale has always been that the benefits don't just accrue to the private landowners, but they accrue to the public at large through habitat, storm surge protection, and other services. So that needs to be at least mentioned, lest somebody say, I'm never going to support any more coastal restoration until we get complete access. I don't think that's going to happen. I think more likely what's going to happen is there may be a way to change the prioritization math, the way we select projects, that's more reflective of a public access directive.
Well, let's break here. I'm sure we'll have a couple more questions for you to close out the hour, Rex. Come right back. We'll be here. Hunt, Fish, Talk. Welcome back in to our final segment this hour of Hunt, Fish, Talk. This is Wendy Billiott. We're here with Don Dubuque, Keith Lusher, and our guest, Rex Caffey of Louisiana Sea Grant. And I hope you're not just now tuning in, because we are about to wrap this thing up. We're talking about the report, and as Rex pointed out, it is 64 pages, but you only have to read the first 24. You don't have to read all the appendices and all the meeting minutes and all those sorts of things. But if you have any interest in that at all, do a Google search for that, and I think you'll be glad you did. I tried to look up the new resolution during the break, and it did not come up on the legislative website. So I'm kind of at a loss here. Rex has mentioned that there's a new task force and House Resolution 90, I think.
Senate,
I'm wondering.
Senate, it was Senate 99, actually. Senate Concurrent Resolution 99.
Ah, okay. I had it wrong. So it's not a House, it's a Senate. That's correct. So, Don, we didn't hear from you last segment at all. What are your questions?
I had a good nap, though. I had a good nap. I'm ready to talk now.
You had a good nap.
Yeah. Rex, I agree with you. You saw from the meetings that the most interest was expressed about getting more funding for that Louisiana State Lands Office to develop some more mapping. I think that's essential. That's got to be done first, because there's still a lot of land in question that we don't know whether we can even argue over it. It may be that the landowners are falsely, maybe they're abusing the system and saying that they do have legal authority over it, when maybe they don't. So that is number one. That's got to be done. Once that is decided, then we can start to argue over whether it's private or public and get a legal, jurisdiction on it, an opinion. But what I'm seeing is, and I kind of share Keith's opinion, I'm really pessimistic on the future of this whole thing. I know some landowners, some smaller landowners, who do have some altruistic interest in this, and they say, look, you protect my liability. Let the state pick up liability if someone gets hurt on my property. Assure me I'm going to have my mineral rights. Prevent people from doing damage to my property. And I'm good with it. I understand. I come from a hunting and fishing family, and I think everyone wants to do that. On the other side of the coin, there are some large corporations that own a lot of our coastal land who don't even live here. They don't even have offices here. And all they look at is a bottom line report on profit and loss. And they are interested in the bottom line, which is money. Which tells me that I think some of the interesting options are going to be Maybe the tax incentives might be the answer. Making sure they get their mineral rights. Possibly the public acquisition, I just don't think there's enough money for that there. But, you know, increase decrease their liability as far as personal injury on their property and that type of thing. But as long as they've got that financial interest in it, and we have laws that were decided before the Civil War, and so far it's all been in the landowner's favor, almost every ruling that has come down. I don't know. What do you think it's going to take on these options to really get the job done? And when something finally comes out, is it going to be kind of a one-size-fits-all, or do you think there'll be several different ways for different landowners to choose options on which is best for them?
Yeah, I think the spirit in which we were instructed to do this report was, again, as Wendy said many times, was to look at voluntary options. So just by definition, it's not a one-size-fits-all. If there are one or two or three or combination of options that this task force moves forward with, my assumption is that those options will be just that, options. And so, in fact, in the report, we suggest that it probably wouldn't be good to, in a wholesale fashion, change policy with the stroke of a pen as far as testing whether it works or not. It might be better to start with a small area where there's a willing landowner, a willing group of a recreational fisherman to see what can be done, and then to build on small successes. But it's going to take a while, and you mentioned something earlier that I have to weigh in on. You know, the state has, through the public trust doctrine, the right to claim property that erodes into an arm of the sea, a navigable waterway or an arm of the sea. And because of that, in certain areas, not everywhere, but in certain areas of the coast, there are what we call dual claimed properties. In fact, depending on which map you look at, it's as little as 300,000 acres to as much as 700,000 acres. Those will have to be, you know, played out in court. And that is, you know, a fair thing to expect. If a landowner believes that he or she has a right to property they paid taxes on for which the boundary is now being claimed by the state, and they want to dispute that, then they have to be what's, you know, called being adjudicated, or a court has to weigh in. That complicates this quite a bit. So I think because of that issue and the complexity of all this, we're really going to probably be looking at voluntary approaches in the short run, short of some change of law, and those will probably be tried on a trial basis to see how they work in certain areas. So I think that's the best we could hope for, in my estimation, right now.
Okay, let's don't just glance over what you just said. You said there may be up to 900,000 acres, did you say?
700,000 acres, yeah. The state land office has a map that shows what's called dual claim lands. The state's claiming they own it, and the private landowner's claiming they own it. There's actually two maps. One is 300,000, and there's actually a larger one that shows up to 700,000 acres of dual claim lands. And because that is a litigation challenge, those are going to have to play out in court on those.
Oh, boundaries. My goodness.
And in those cases, the policy, as we understand it through our report of the state land office, is that the public enters those areas at their own risk. I know that's not a very comforting thing, but it's the best that they can do until the legal determinations are made. Those boundary maps are, again, available online and through the state land office.
This is really no small piece of this puzzle.
No, it's not. It underlies everything. And I think it gets back to this issue that really we began our report with and what we've talked about this morning, is that whether we like it or not, Louisiana's just tremendous crisis of coastal deterioration is really at the heart of this. It's what makes this a difficult, even more difficult challenge beyond Napoleonic law or any sort of antiquated complaints about how we own or allocate resources. We have this landscape that's dissolving underneath our feet as we speak, and it makes it very difficult. So for those reasons, I tend to think that voluntary options that are tested or demonstrated on a trial basis and we build from there are probably the best thing, and then we need to couple that with more resources towards the state land office. I wish I could be a little bit more definitive and positive, but I think that's where we are right now in the summer of 2018 on this.
Is Sea Grant involved in this new Resolution 99?
We are. We've been named, and I think it's because of our role to date. But there are groups with much more capacity than we have. We have a small legal program that's very effective when they led the development of this report, but I think the Louisiana Law Institute was also going to be on this task force. I will say that for public entities like Wallace and Fisheries or Sea Grant, while we're named on a task force, we typically don't vote on policy matters. We just serve as subject matter advisors.
Don, did you have a follow-up question in regarding Rex's answer to you?
No, I just wanted to say, you know, congratulations to him and Rex. I'm sure you realize what a big job you've got. I mean, this is a very important issue, probably the biggest in the history of the state as far as the coastal zone. And to be sitting right in the middle of it or, in fact, on top of it is a very important role. And hope you're going to be up for the task because I don't see this being solved anytime soon. If nothing else, you got job security.
So far, perhaps. Okay. I do want to end again, if anybody wants to see the report, rather than giving you a web address, just go to Google and type in Louisiana Coastal Access Report. The first couple of hits you'll see will be links to our study, Louisiana Coastal Access Report.
Okay. Rex Caffey, one more question for you. Do you see this following the same format, this task force? Closed meetings with each individual user group?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that. My guess is it'll probably be subject to open public meeting laws, and so there'll be an opportunity for some observation, but I could be wrong.
Okay, so as listeners, we need to pay attention and see if there are some announcements, if these meetings are open to the public, and if you are a stakeholder, if you're a small landowner, if you're just an everyday fisherman, get involved. Rex, we thank you so much for your time. Don and Keith, as usual, it was wonderful. Great being with you guys. I hope everybody has a great weekend, regardless of the west wind. You've been listening
thank
to
you, Wendy.
Fish Talk. Thank you.
Thanks, Rex. Thanks, Don. Thanks, Wendy.
Yeah, want to reserve the right to get Rex back, too, as needed.
Happy to
yes,
do it.
Rex.
Absolutely.
Say you will. Thank you so much.
All right.
All right, coming up next, Keith, what you got?
Oh, we got three guests. We're going to be talking a lot about freshwater fishing. Chris Bacy, Todd Ullman, and we've got a kids fishing tournament coming up as well. So we'll get into all of that the next hour on the North Shore Fishing Report.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.